Let me tell you of the days of high adventure.
Kevin.
And I'm John.
And this is 6 Degrees of Schwarzenegger, the podcast where we take a long, hard look back at some of our favorite action movies from the era of Arnold.
Schwarzenegger is the icon of the genre, and we're taking a deep dive into some of these 80s and 90s cult action movies, and we're breaking them all the way down.
We're going to get into the nitty-gritty and examine the good, the bad, the ugly, and the laughable in these movies.
But we're always coming from a place of love. You don't watch these movies as much as we have unless you have a genuine affection for them.
Everybody.
Hello. Hello, Gavna.
Is that Australia?
No, it's not.
It's Kevin and John here.
Hey,
and
guys.
We're joined by 6 Degrees of Schwarzenegger founding member,
that's
Mike.
That's right.
Howdy. What's
the
up?
The original, the best.
OG. Right.
Glad to be back.
Man, thanks for being with us.
Oh, no problem.
This is exciting to have Mike back in
it
the
is.
Saddle.
It's great to have Mike here. It's great to be talking about one of my favorite movies, like from my childhood. I'll just go ahead and say that, and I think I've said this before on the podcast, that this is maybe the first movie that I remember seeing in the theater ever.
Oh, wow.
That's awesome.
And wow. I remember being pissed when Mick Dundee never pulled the buildings apart like he did on the movie poster.
You thought he was going to get huge?
Because I was.
You think this was going to be Crocodile Rampage?
Because I was 4 years old and stupid as shit.
I definitely didn't see this in the theater. I was like, my parents were not taking me to see anything that was adult
right
entertainment at that time.
So I was actually 15 when the movie came out, so I'm a little older than you
hey.
Guys. Yeah.
Did you see it in the theater?
I didn't see it in the theaters. Although it is PG-13, but I probably saw it HBO. Like, I went over to my cousin's house or something like that. That's the only way I remember seeing it. I remember being, like, awestruck by the movie.
Yeah.
I knew who Paul Hogan was before any of this stuff came out.
You were
right?
A Paul Hogan hipster.
Yeah, so I used to watch the Paul Hogan show as a kid. I used to watch it on wherever it came on, like the public broadcasting in North Carolina. And I used to watch the show and just thought it was hilarious. It was kind of like a Benny Hill or a Monty Python or something like that.
Okay, like a Russ Abbott show kind of vibe from it.
Yeah.
Cool.
So I knew who Paul Hogan was before this movie came out. And I remember being like super excited. Like, oh, I know that. It's like, you know, like your best friend puts out a movie.
That's
like,
cool.
I know that guy. So it'll be cool to see what he does as a film.
So for those of you who haven't caught on yet, we are talking about 1986's amazing Crocodile Dundee.
Oh yeah,
probably like as iconic of a movie as we've ever talked about on
Definitely.
The podcast. I don't even know if it's technically an action movie, but
yeah, this is one of those movies you. It's hard to talk shit about. It's not like the best movie ever made, but man, is it fun! It's sort of
it's like
up there with Lethal
but it's
Weapon
an adventure. It's not like overly violent or overly like. No titties in it or anything like that.
Yeah, it's surprisingly clean.
Yeah, it's funny to say that because I remember thinking this is not an action film. This is basically a love story disguised
as an
action film.
It's like a romance adventure type thing, which was a hot genre at that time.
Yeah, kind of like Romancing the Stone or something like that.
Exactly, yeah.
This came out in 86, and I think it was like the second highest grossing film of that year.
Second highest grossing
behind Top Gun. Yeah.
I know this movie was like hot. So I'm surprised you didn't see it just because I guess everyone saw it.
I might have seen it in the theater. I just don't remember. It was been that
he
long.
He was blackout drunk at 15.
It's been that long ago. I probably was. But I do remember seeing it and being like, it's one of those things where you're like, this is one of the best things I've ever seen ever, right?
Yeah.
So I'm glad you asked me to do this movie because
we gave you options
memories.
And you jumped right on.
Yeah.
Crocodile.
I forget what the other movie was, but
Passenger 57, which
like,
is also awesome.
And I like Wesley Snipes, but I mean Blade on after, you know.
Yeah.
And we should talk about Paul Hogan,
sure,
since he's sort of like everything,
right,
on this movie.
Yeah, we were just talking about how the generational likability of this movie, some 30 years later, all hangs on Paul Hogan's performance.
Yeah,
he is like you hang your hat on this movie on him.
Well, like I mentioned before, Paul Hogan had this show, the Paul Hogan Show, right?
Right, right.
And I feel like he got together with a bunch of his friends because I know that the director, Peter, I think his name is Feynman, or how you pronounce it. He worked on the Paul Hogan Show also. Uh-huh. So he probably had a bunch of his friends from that show, and he was like, look, I have this idea. Let's make it into a movie. And you guys know that this is based on, like, a true story, right?
I felt like I read somewhere that it was based on a guy.
I took notes. Yeah, the guy claims that at least. Ansel. Although there's some similarities between it. He didn't get attacked by a crocodile or anything. Like, he just got
he was like
lost in the wilderness for
like
a while.
He was like a Bear Grylls kind of guy.
And he came back out and was like,
holy shit, mate.
Sort of had a, he got like a 15 minutes of fame type thing.
Yeah. Right. I think he got together with a bunch of his friends and he was like, hey, I want to make this movie based on this guy's life. And all of them were.
Or let's rip off his life.
It worked, right?
But like, you knew who Paul Hogan was. Like, I had no knowledge of who he is before this movie.
Same.
Or his history, even before researching for this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, he didn't just come in entertainment. He was, like, a construction worker type guy.
Yeah, a truck driver or something.
It said he was a rigger. He worked, like, painting the Sydney Harbor Bridge.
What? That's awesome.
And stuff. Yeah, like, which was built years and years and years before, but like he'd do maintenance on it, I guess, and shit like that. So
he's like Harrison Ford.
I was thinking the exact same thing. Get out of my head.
He kind of has that vibe, doesn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, he is like Australian Indiana Jones.
Sure, and I think back then you could get away with that. Like you could be like a construction worker. You know, I want to do movies, and so then become like an action star. I think that was easier back in the 80s.
Of course.
Yeah.
So basically, in 1971, he's 32 years old. He's sort of like conned his way onto this show. It's basically like the Australian version of America's Got Talent,
mm-hmm.
where the judges would like make fun of bad performance, like Simon Cowell style. And his thing was he told, I guess, the producers that he was a tap dancing knife thrower. And then once he got on stage, he sort of just did a comedy, like a stand up routine, making fun of the judges.
Mm-hmm.
And the crowd like loved that shit. And first, I gotta say, imagine a scenario in which you say you're a skilled knife thrower and they're putting you on national TV without, like, requiring you to perform for them before
like
you
can prove it.
Can you do it once for us just so that we know you're real?
Yeah, but I feel like Paul Hogan's the type of guy. He's just, like, a charming person.
Oh, yeah, he's
right?
Like he's got the gift of gab.
Yeah.
But so he parlayed that into, like, regular TV appearances on various shows. Until he got the Paul Hogan Show, which started in 1973. It was a big hit in Australia and then got really popular in South Africa and the UK. And
blowing
popular
up
enough here that the young Mike watched it.
I vividly remember watching the show.
And he did like cigarette commercials, Foster's commercials.
Which we're drinking right now.
Drinking some Foster's here in solidarity. And commercials for Australian tourism.
So quick question. Was all this before...
Yeah.
It was before Dundee.
Okay, all right.
It was when the show was biggish,
sure,
I guess.
Okay.
And he was, like, maybe the most famous Australian.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
I think Put Another Shrimp on the Barbie was, like
was
on the tourism campaign
sure,
or something.
Sure, sure. Because it was my understanding, and I'm not doubting what you're saying, it was my understanding that when they made this movie, they made it partly because they wanted to increase Australia's visibility to the world, right? It was almost like a giant commercial for Australia, right?
Truly.
Or they wanted to make something that would be commercially successful in the United States.
Yeah.
So again, I don't remember any of this. Just it's coming off the top of my head. But I thought all that stuff happened after.
No.
Again, I'm not doubting you. But it's just how I remember it, right?
Sure.
Yeah. It seemed like it was, to me, like for the world, I guess, at large, I think it was this movie. His first movie that he ever did.
The 80s were a banner decade for Australian films.
Oh, yeah, the Mad Max
Mad
stuff.
Mad Maxes and, dude.
But this, like, obviously made him a global superstar at age 47. Is it just interesting?
He's fucking 83 years old now.
He was 47 when he made?
Yeah.
Dude,
that is
some
Harrison Ford shit.
He aged well, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
For a chain smoker, he was working out.
Somebody who lived in the sun, too.
his face showed it, you know, the lines and everything like that. But,
so, I know he was 47 when he made that.
I know, man. So, directed by Peter Feynman,
yep.
as you mentioned, he hasn't really directed Anything else other than the episodes of the Paul Hogan
Show? He directed the Thanksgiving classic Dutch with Ed O'Neill and Ethan Embry.
Are you serious?
Which I've never seen.
Oh, man, you need to cue that up.
We talked about that shit on our Predator episode because I had this theory that all the best characters ever in films have been named Dutch. Which is basically just that. Dutch from Karate Kid and then Dutch Ed O'Neill.
Sure. Yeah. Was Dutch in Karate Kid, is he the one that died?
Yeah, the one that died
in real life.
No, no, that's Chad McQueen as Dutch. Oh, okay. Like Steve McQueen's that's son. Right.
So the guy that played Dutch just didn't want to come back for the thing?
Something like that. Okay. He was doing something else or he
I'm
just
too
didn't
busy.
Want to. That's I mean, right. I think he's got that Steve McQueen money. He's probably off racing race cars and some shit.
I mean, he does want to come back and make Karate Kid. I mean, but that's a story for another day.
That's right. He also produced Ferngully, The Last Rainforest, incidentally.
Oh, did Feynman
Peter,
did?
Peter, yeah, Peter Feynman.
I mean, that's I feel awesome. Like in
was
Hollywood.
Was that an Australian production?
I don't know. I thought it was like a Don Bluth movie or something.
I mean, it was Ferngully. I mean, it's Disney, got Australia written all over it,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it sounds like it. Ferngully.
Yeah. But I feel like in Hollywood, you only really need to have like one big hit, right?
Oh.
And then you're set. Then you can kind of decide what
ladies
you
and gentlemen, I present Paul Hogan.
Which I feel like is Paul. Yeah, he's like, I do something when I feel like it.
Yeah.
Like, I'll do a sequel. If I get inspired to do a project, I'll do a project.
Yeah.
I can respect that. He's not like just looking to get as famous as he can. Because I'm sure he passed up tons of offers.
He did, because he apparently, after this, got tons of offers for more action-y roles.
Yeah.
But he turned them down, saying that the scene, meaning Hollywood, was screaming out for heroes that don't kill 75 people. And he's like, the world doesn't need more Terminators or Rambos. Commandos or Rambos. He was like, mix a role model, and he's not a whimper sissy just because he doesn't kill people. Which, I was like,
I read that quote too, and I like that. It's like, you can be a man and masculine and a strong person without being violent. I would also, like, without killing people.
I never realized that was like, like, people thought that. Like, yeah. Like, you have to be a man, you have to kill people.
In the 80s.
Yeah, well, now. He also apparently turned down the Patrick Swayze role in Ghost. I can't confirm that, but I read
that too, and I can't even...
With Demi Moore
cast? Yes, and Whoopi.
I can't even envision that.
Yeah, I can't see that at all.
But I read the same thing, so it must be true.
It's on the internet. Seriously,
they cast Demi Moore... And they were like, let's get Paul Hogan.
Do you think
he was hot at the moment?
He was a big deal.
Oh, when did Ghost come out?
89?
I was about to say 89, 90.
I thought it came out in like 91 or 92.
It might have been 90.
Maybe Paul Hogan was still...
He would have been coming out the sequel.
50 at that point, right?
Well, yeah, he would have been coming out the sequel and the success of the Subaru Outback commercials in the 80s and 90s. That 90s and early aughts.
Dude, that sequel was legit.
I was watching it earlier.
Like, I don't want to see it now.
I can lend you my Blu-ray.
Yeah, you have the sequel
of Crocodile Dundee 2.
Yeah,
yes,
It came in both of them together for like $10. Like,
it's dark. It's a much darker chapter in the. In the
it is, but that's what I like.
Crocodile Dundee and the Temple of Doom.
Exactly.
Produced by a dude named John Cornell, who was instrumental in helping Hogan get his big break. He had been a producer of a show that Hogan appeared on regularly, and then he became Hogan's manager and business partner and a co-star on the Paul Hogan Show.
John Cornell died this past July, RIP.
Oh, bummer. Yep. I didn't see that.
Yep.
Written by Hogan.
Hey.
Cornell and another guy, Ken Shady, who was a longtime writer on the Paul Hogan Show. He never wrote another thing after this.
That's crazy.
It was Paul Hogan Show and Crocodile Dundee and no more credits for him after that.
So this movie made off of like, what, $8.8
million?
Like
$350 like million. Almost, bucks.
Yeah, something like that. So
do you would he not?
He had to have been getting pleased. Like, we just want your name from the writer of Crocodile, because he was Oscar nominated. All of them were for the screenplay.
Yeah, but I think that again, this would be like if we wrote a movie, right? Like just a bunch of guys who are friends, and we're just like, you know what? We really enjoy this thing, right?
Yeah.
So let's write a movie about it, and we do, and it out of nowhere becomes like this huge success.
Uh-huh. I promise, if it made $1 billion, we'd be getting offers. What else you got?
We would get offers, but when we. Would we want to...
You say, well, that was fun.
Will we do that? Or would we want to...
I'd want to write something else if I had ideas.
But I'd at least want to try.
You would want to write what you want to write, though. Like, I can imagine they got offers, right? But they were like, hey, write this Star Wars knockoff or write this Terminator knockoff, right? And they didn't want to do any of that, right?
So, if you didn't have more original ideas.
Yeah, like,
yeah,
or just
I can see that.
Write your own thing, then they probably could have gotten away with it, but...
I can see that, I think. Like how if and especially if you're like, hey, I'm set for life and I just want to live a quiet life with my family. I don't need to be a
whatever, touring around, doing press junkets and shit, whatever they were doing back
then. So George Miller is probably a good example, right? Like, he's Australian, and he did Mad Max for the love of doing film, right? Mm-hmm. Like, wasn't he a doctor first? And he was like...
He was a doctor. He was a doctor, crazy to me.
And he was like, I want to make a movie. And so he made a movie, and he loved what he did. But you don't think of George Miller as, like, knocking out, like you don't think of George Miller like you think of Steven Spielberg,
who's
knocking out all these movies every single year, right?
Well, he's another dude who has a passion project. And
exactly.
Or like a James Cameron. Like, he puts out a movie when he feels like putting out a movie.
Yeah, exactly.
Not like, I just want to stay busy.
But I also think James Cameron does it for the money. More so than George Miller.
But I think he won't, like, I don't think you could say, hey, James Cameron, how much money would it take for you to do a new Superman movie?
He'd say no.
I think he'd say, no, I want to tell the story I want to tell.
Right.
Like,
if you'll pay me exorbitant sums,
but
I
he's
will
also
do that.
Doing Avatar too.
But I think
I know what you're saying,
he loves that world, and I'm not sold on these sequels.
I'm not either.
We'll see how that goes.
It was called Fern Gully, The Last Rainforest. We've already talked about it.
Oh, we already covered that.
Yeah.
Music by Peter Best.
He never did anything else that you'd be like, oh, I love that score. I never, but the,
he
this
did a bunch of
right.
Australian productions. The music in this one killed for
me.
I love it.
I like the integration of didgeridoo at tasteful moments.
But he's definitely not the fifth Beatle.
No, not that
Pete Best.
We should also point out DP on this movie, Russell Boyd, who won the Oscar for Master and Commander with Russell Crowe. He also did a bunch of great Australian movies, Gallipoli with Mel Gibson. He also did Year of Living Dangerously with Mel Gibson. White Men Can't Jump and many, many others.
White Men Can't Jump is interesting.
So no, that guy had a career.
He came to Hollywood and...
But then there's another awesome connection to a movie we've done previously. The costume design was Norma Morisot, who we've mentioned as being responsible for the awesome costumes in Road Warrior, Beyond Thunderdome, Island of Dr. Moreau. So she was responsible for this movie.
So I know I'm jumping like way, way ahead.
Hit it.
As you mentioned the costume designer, and I remember looking at some of the outfits that Mick Dundee...
In Australia?
No, in New York.
Okay.
And I was thinking
like
to myself, those are some...
jacket?
Yeah. I was like, those are some nice duds this dude is wearing. Like, he doesn't seem like the kind of guy, if he's like this bush...
Everything...
He skinned his own crocodiles, don't you think?
Yeah, but I was like...
He tailors his own clothes.
Like, I can't believe that didn't make like a huge fashion statement.
Oh, in the 80s?
Like in the 80s, where people were wearing like the boots and the leather pants.
The snakeskin boots were huge.
Yeah, yeah,
I don't know about like
snakeskin
jackets.
I do remember people wearing boots a lot.
Yeah, I'm sure people were fucking with that stuff after
like
the
that,
movie
once
came out.
Once he... walks out in the iconic knife scene. Like, that's a nice suit.
But with the leather jacket, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And the hat with the crocodile tooth band around it.
Yes.
It's awesome.
So, movie starred Paul Hogan, we've mentioned.
Who's he?
As Michael J. Crocodile Dundee, a.k.a. Mick. Yeah, he did this. The sequels, Lightning Jack, is the only other thing I remember of his.
Oh, Angel.
He did a movie called
Almost Angels.
Yeah. Done a bunch of work in Australia, stuff that I haven't seen. But anytime he puts something out, it's like the biggest thing that year in Australia.
Sure.
Aforementioned Subaru Outback commercial.
Yes. It is iconic, though, impressive how iconic he is over such a small body of work.
Yeah.
Like, he had that one role that's like 35 years later is still iconic.
I mean, like, when you think of Australia, who else do you think of outside of Mel Gibson?
Nicole Hemsworth now, maybe?
Hugh Jackman.
Huge Jackman.
I don't even think of Hugh Jackman as Australian. I don't, but...
Yeah, I mean, but I'm just thinking of, like, I think Nicole Kidman's probably the most famous Australian. Mm-hmm. But Naomi Watts is Australian.
Hugo Weaving.
What's that, Keith Urban?
None of those are from New Zealand. They're all Australian?
I think they are, yeah. Yeah, that country singer.
Keith Urban. Random. So random. Uh-huh. Fucking what? You can't say country.
But you know what? None of them would have made it without Paul Hogan.
I probably 100% agree with you on that statement.
We weren't importing Australians before.
Mel Gibson came first. Yeah.
Yeah.
But Paul Hogan, I think, definitely paved the way. At least that's our theory.
And
that's
Mel Gibson, when he came over, he had to try to lose the accent.
Right,
you know,
that's
true. For almost everything.
He's not even really Australian.
Yeah, he is American.
Yes,
American.
He fakes it. He's like Christian Bale's English accent.
It's
not real.
When did Mad Max come out?
The original one was 80.
The first one might have been 79 or something.
Yeah, I think it was.
So
several years
was 81.
Several years before this movie.
Yeah. That was the biggest, yeah, that was like the thing I think that put Australian cinema on the map was the Mad Max stuff.
But I think the difference between, and I don't know if we're getting off subject here, I think the difference between like Mad Max.
There is no subject, Mike. Go with it.
The difference between Mad Max and Crocodile Dundee is Mad Max could have been anywhere, right? It just so happens to be in Australia.
That's a great point.
Crocodile Dundee was like, they were like,
this motherfucker is from Australia. Yeah. Like,
this is Australia, motherfucker.
Yeah, they were full. Yeah,
Mad Max could have happened in any country in the world.
That's a great point.
Or on any continent.
Yeah.
Also starring Linda Kozlowski as Sue Charlton.
In her first role.
Introducing
Sue.
So both the leads doing their first ever movie.
And then they got married.
Yeah, sometime later.
Got married in 1990, divorced in 2013.
That's a bummer.
Yeah.
She was like a Juilliard-trained stage actor. They found her in New York, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Also starring, I don't know how to say his name, John Malon?
I'm probably saying Malon.
He played Walter Riley, a.k.a. Wally, a.k.a. Walt.
Yeah.
Just pick a name.
He was like a working Aussie actor.
Easily the second best character in that film.
Yeah.
He never really left Australia. I mean, I only know him from this and the sequel.
He died just a couple of years after this, too.
He died just after part two.
He looked old.
Now, how old do you think he was in this movie?
The guy that played Walt?
Well, now,
yeah, if you don't know.
If you don't know. Hogan was 47, and I didn't even know that.
Yeah. How old do you think
he had to be?
Wally was?
66.
I would guess mid-50s just because of how weathered the Australian sun would do a body.
So he was 51.
Oh. What?
He was like a couple years older than Paul Hogan.
He had that cirrhotic liver.
He died young. He was 55 in 1989.
Rest in peace, John Malon.
I mean, he's Australian, but they look like they party hard.
Yeah. They do. They throw down on the most inhospitable bit of Earth on the planet.
Which I definitely would have said, you know, Paul Hogan's 40 and Malon is 60.
See, yeah.
Because he seemed like he's playing a mentor character to him.
Yeah,
like
totally.
It's always a generation older.
It's always interesting when you like see the movie and the lead is this age and then their father figure or their mother figure is like literally like 5 years older than them, but they look like they're 20 years older.
You definitely get Marcus Brody vibes from Walt in this movie, like from Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What about, I can, as always, Mike, I would say don't worry about rambling because if you bore me, I'll just chop it out.
Okay.
But I'll ramble now and say the dude Terry Silver from Karate Kid 3, who's going to be in the new season of Cobra Kai.
Super fucking excited.
He's younger than Ralph Macchio.
What the fuck? Are you kidding me?
He's six months younger. Say that again.
The guy who played Terry Silver, like
the villain of
Karate Kid 3, not Mike Barnes.
Oh, the one with the
ponytail.
Back hair.
Yeah. The evil industrialist.
Is 6 months.
The guy who fought in Vietnam with John Kreese is 6 months younger than Ralph Macchio.
That's insane.
He looks young in Karate Kid 3, but not 6 months. But Ralph Macchio is like well known for.
But Macchio
like
was like, and he was 30 when they were doing part three. But so was
that's insanity
that guy.
To me. That's absolutely mind. You've just bottled my mind.
Yeah, that's crazy. Can I say one quick
right
thing?
Up.
Say it.
So you had talked about Linda Kozlowski and how they got married after this film. Or like
he was married at the time, which makes it problematic.
He was married at the time. And I think he left his wife for Linda Kozlowski. I remember that being like a...
It was a big deal.
Yeah, I remember that being like a tabloid thing.
Because he was like a global star at that time. Yeah, it's fucked up. Never mind. We'll get to it real soon. I have more notes.
They have like mad chemistry, though, in this movie.
Yeah,
so I see it.
I mean, you can't argue with that. Starring also Mark Blum as Richard.
Yeah, he's a guy you love to hate in the 80s movies.
He still
and
is
TV.
Working, does just a lot of TV shit.
Mm-hmm.
And I gotta mention small part, but Reginald Vell Johnson.
Oh yeah,
as
man,
Gus.
The great Reginald Vell Johnson.
That had to be like his first big starring film, right?
Or he was in Ghostbusters.
Is the
prison guard Ghostbusters? The mayor wants to see you.
Oh, okay.
Reginald getting it done.
That's amazing to me.
Yeah. How awesome is it that like he was just on screen and then everyone's like, God, that guy.
Remember the
guard in Ghostbusters? Give me that guy.
Well, I just think of like imagine saying even if your parts were small, saying I was in Ghostbusters and Crocodile Dundee and Die Hard.
I'm pretty sure it's...
Family Matters, I'm sure, paid him more than anything.
I'm pretty sure he says I was in Die Hard, though.
But, you know, imagine just having that resume. Yeah. Like, even... I think of this dude from Karate Kid, the guy who played Freddy Fernandez.
Yeah.
Is like, just his neighbor in the apartment building, the one who invites him to the beach party. Mm-hmm. He was also played the dude who brought, like, the room service out to Taggart and Rosewood in Beverly Hills Cop. And it's like, imagine saying, I was in Karate Kid and Beverly Hills Cop in back-to-back years.
Yeah,
two of the biggest movies of their year and of the whole decade.
And you know that's like, awesome. You know those movies are popular because of me, right? You know that, right?
Yeah, for sure. Definitely. You definitely got laid off that. Yeah. But yeah, Reginald Val Johnson, awesome, dude.
Then David, we should mention David Gulpilil as Neville.
Yes. His buddy turns up when they're in the Outback.
Yeah.
Who was like a famous dancer. He's a famous like choreographer and
he's got
tribal
moves
dancer
in this movie. Yeah.
Awesome.
He
stuff.
Was the Australian John Travolta.
That's awesome.
So I guess there's a movie more to
at
talk
long
about.
Last, we kick it off.
But yeah, before we get started, I mean, it's kind of like the awesome thing about talking about movies is you get to go into like you love these movies so much that you want to just like do a deep dive into everything that ever happened to anybody that was involved in the movie, right?
It's so interesting, as I've learned from doing this podcast, like how, especially in the action movie world, how incestuous it all is. Like the dude who did the music for Roadhouse also did the music for Lethal Weapon and for Die Hard, and like the same stunt coordinator and the same dudes just turn up over and over and over again.
Absolutely. Yeah, especially back then when it was like a much smaller
It was like
community.
A tight-knit little community.
Yeah.
But I guess with all that in mind, we'll talk about another movie we watched Once Upon a Time. But before we do that...
That's Foster's.
That work for you? That's
Australian for beer.
Well, now the can says Australia's famous beer brand. Australia's famous beer brand.
I don't see those commercials for Foster's much anymore.
No.
I don't recall, but they still are making that big-ass can, though,
Foster's
man.
Foster's is American for Australian beer.
So where'd you get that? Did you get that at Publix, or did you get that at a dime down the street?
It was at my Kroger, $2 a can.
Nice.
For the 25 and a quarter ounce can or some shit. It's 750 milliliters.
Of 5% alcohol by volume.
It'll get you there.
So it is just barely alcoholic beer. So without any further ado... I love the old Paramount screen kicking this movie off. It takes me right back. I love that shit. So we immediately get a downtown Manhattan skyline at night. We see the Twin Towers.
Yeah, prominent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's amazing how much of a character the Twin Towers were in movies of this time.
Dude. Yeah, Think about the new 90s. King Kong, the 70s King Kong. Didn't he climb one of the Twin Towers, the Empire State Building?
Yeah, it definitely adds like a legitimacy to a movie when you see it. It's like, oh, okay.
They don't have that in Toronto or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's like, oh, this is New York, all right.
Yeah, so we see bustling street outside the offices of Newsday.
It's a real newspaper.
Yeah.
It is?
That was a little strange to me.
Yeah, I don't know that.
It was like they covered like Long Island news primarily. They're still in print.
I was
going
to say, they must have paid the Bono money from over the top to be the sponsor.
So you're telling me they were just like, we don't feel like buying like a new sign for...
I don't know.
Like, we'll just pay somebody.
We don't want to be the New York
why they weren't the New York Herald Daily. Or whatever. No one knows.
Exactly. I was about to say, it reminds me of the Daily Planet.
I wish this should have taken place in a DC universe.
Oh, that'd be rad.
So we hear a conversation on a phone call. A man, Richard, is trying to persuade Sue to come back home. He says, I'm not complaining about your work. It's terrific. But you were due back in New York. Like, okay, fine. Sue, who's in Sydney, Australia, says there's one more story she has to do. She recounts...
Linda... She is beautiful. She caught my eye.
I told you.
Mike was saying, like, you, back in the day, you weren't sold on her, but watching her more recently,
I was saying is that I don't remember her beauty. I don't remember, because I hadn't seen the movie in so long, and I remember looking at today and just her beauty, like, really sticking out. She's gorgeous, man.
I'll talk a lot about it.
When I was watching this movie, the first time I saw her, I was like, that woman is Kevin's type. So, all of our listeners out there, if you've got a sister... that looks like 28 years old Linda Kozlowski.
Yeah.
Yeah, send her our way.
What about her room, her hotel room? That, like, the view?
Yeah, right of the harbor and the bridge.
It's the opera house and the bridge that Paul Hogan worked on.
Yeah.
So what story was she working on?
That's what I want to know. She's doing lots of stories, and now she's in Australia. She just, like, checks in every couple of days.
There doing a story.
People out on Long Island are really, like, hyped up for stories about Australia.
Exactly.
Yes. I don't know.
I actually kind of buy that.
Unless that's, like, some kind of global trade.
I think she's
trade.
Just spending that money. She's spending the newspaper money to
that's
take
right.
a vacation.
That's probably why they're, yeah.
Yeah, she
that's
says,
why he's like, get your ass back to New York. Because why are you spending all this money? Because he was throwing money around like,
Yeah, the whole movie.
All Milly Willy.
So she tells this guy, Richard, that she's there to find this dude from the Northern Territory who is attacked by a croc. What was she wearing in this scene? It's like a huge print shirt with like old TVs and radios.
I caught her leg though when her leg peeked out.
I dig her shirt, whatever she's wearing.
Yeah, it was nice. Her fashion in this movie was like,
well, that's what I'm saying.
On trend.
More
now,
so,
I think.
She looks amazing, but she also sometimes looks like fucking Greta Garbo inexplicably with her like head wraps and
sunglasses. Yeah, there's that one. Yeah, the one scene where she like is like, screw you, I'm gonna walk on by myself, and then she has like on this giant like hat.
She looks like girls who are like influencers.
Her hat and mosquito net scarf. We'll get there.
Yeah. She looks like an influencer.
Like, what?
That's what I'm
exactly
saying. Like she'd be on
like.
Point on Instagram.
That's exactly
today.
What she looks like.
Yeah.
So apparently, the guy that she's looking for had his leg bitten off, and a week later, crawled out of the bush, got patched up, and then disappeared. No pictures. No interviews. No one knows where the guy is. Richard, on the other line, on the other end of the phone, is like not impressed. So she tells him, I've tracked him down. He runs a safari company out in a tiny town called Walkabout Creek, and his name is, get this, Michael J. Fox. No, Crocodile Dundee. Richard is like,
Wait, can we leave already?
Yeah.
I don't know if you've been listening, but there's a rule that John has that once the title of the film is said within the film,
sure,
then you can
you're
walk
free to
out
leave.
If you
gotcha.
Want to.
You should get an immediate refund, too. It's like if they say it in the first like 5 minutes, it's like, oh, well, I can leave now.
Did you see early drafts of this movie were titled Buffalo Jones? He's going to be Buffalo Jones, not Crocodile Dundee. I read an interview with the guy Shady, the writer.
I like that. Buffalo Jones.
That would have been too much like Indiana Jones.
That's
though.
True. Buffalo Jones.
And why not Water Buffalo Jones? Like,
I think if you're in Australia, that's just a buffalo.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, Richard on the other end is skeptical. He says, even if it's true, it's going to take you weeks to find the guy. But she's like, I've already made all the arrangements. So go fuck yourself. Richard's like, fine. He's like, I really miss you, darling. So it's clear that there's some like romantic entanglement happening.
Or at least
there.
He is.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. He is.
Foreshadowing. Yeah. He tells her to be careful. She says, don't worry, I'm a New Yorker.
That line right there kind of sets up the whole movie right there.
Dude, yeah, definitely.
It's an efficient bit of storytelling.
Yeah,
like,
totally.
This 90 seconds or 1 minute or something has like set the stage for everything you need to know.
I would imagine that this would be like the script that you would show in like a screenwriting class and be like, this is the way you write a script.
But this movie that's like 90 minutes long or like barely over an hour and a half, like so much shit happens.
This,
but it also doesn't feel rushed.
Oscar nominated, right?
Yeah, nominated
Oscar
for best
original screenplay.
Best original screenplay.
And then, and then you read some reviews.
Yeah.
And like the reviews were like, eh. No one really liked it.
Well,
the critical reception.
Rotten Tomatoes has got a solid like an 88%, but a lot of critics were down on it. Notably, Ebert.
Yeah, Ebert was like
middle of the road.
He's like, it should have been. It feels like a Clark Gable, Carol Lombard movie that never got made.
Which it does have that feeling. Yeah. Like the sassy New York reporter is going to go
spunky.
And meet like a rugged, it's like it happened one night type shit or whatever.
Yeah. Or even like African Queen. Or
How does Rotten Tomato work with films that were made before Rotten Tomato?
That's a great question.
I think they just go round up all the old. They just go look at all the old reviews and average out.
Sure.
The positives and negatives, like to give it a percentage. Yeah.
Okay.
Because it's not new reviews. It's all the old shit that was written way back then.
Which I appreciate that somebody went through and did like. Aggregated
all
that
data.
Doing
the hard work for podcasters
like us. So we cut to just some badass, like. Natural photography of the outback. Mm-hmm. Fuck yeah.
Killer music.
Yeah, I was about to sing the running man. Yeah. So the helicopter, I love the shot. The opening shot of the helicopter like zooming over is badass during the title sequence.
Sure.
The theme music is awesome. Pervasive use of the tritone. The devil's interval, interestingly enough. We cut to an older gentleman. This is Wally. Nervously combing his hair as he waits beside. It looks like a little like a short bed El Camino or something.
Yeah. I know. That was kind of pimping, though. Like yeah, his little truck. I saw that truck and I thought, oh, John's going to like that vehicle. It's like a bespoke thing. Like you said, like someone's rigged it. It's like something out of Mad Max.
So, I mean,
like something that's just been slapped together.
Yeah. I feel like all the vehicles in this movie were like.
Especially the safari truck.
Junkyard somewhere and just put it together.
Yeah, the vehicle that he's in is marked Never Never Safari Tours. Helicopter comes in for landings, blowing dust and shit on this guy. Chickens are flying everywhere.
Yeah.
It's kind of awesome.
There should have been I don't know if it's in the credits, but no animals were harmed in the making of this movie.
There should. I had that thought later on in the fishing scene.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe they were harmed.
Man,
you don't know.
Barramundi. So the older man approaches the helicopter. Sue's like walking towards him with her things. He introduces himself as Walter Riley of Never Never Safari, Never Never Safaris, and business partner of Crocodile Dundee. He loads all her bags in the back of his vehicle and helps her in. He apologizes that Mick's not there to meet her himself, but that he is in town somewhere.
It's good, like. It's a good touch to sort of add that anticipation. Or
I'll say this guy...
Hold back, but you don't get to meet the title character right away.
Yeah.
So I got that he was kind of pissed. Like, because these two guys are in, like, a business together. And he's like, well, Mick should have been here, but he's not here. And he's like, oh, this is Mick again.
Well, totally. Like, Walt is like he's the business savvy guy.
Exactly.
And you know, Dundee is the talent.
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
So he pulls up in front of the Walkabout Creek Hotel. There's a Foster sign above the door. Cheers to all of our Aussie friends out there, or all of our American friends drinking what used to be an Aussie beer.
Damn, it looked hot there.
Yeah, it did. It looked arid. So they get out, and as she's having a look around, he welcomes her to town. It definitely not much to look at. It is barren.
It's like a ghost town, yeah.
He tells her he took the liberty of booking her in the hotel, and then he confirms with her that she said that she's prepared to pay $2,500 for this exclusive story with Mick J. Dundee.
I did research on how much money is that. I don't know, like in 87.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Apparently.
And in
Australian dollars.
In Australian dollars, too, because they have English pound, right?
Oh, I think they have their own unit currency. Of money.
Oh, they're, okay.
So $2,500 Australian dollars is the same as about $6,000 Australian dollars today.
Okay.
Which is
okay.
About the same as $4,500 US dollars.
Sure.
Which.
And that's just for an interview and some pictures?
And the excursion, right? Like to guide her through.
Because at this time, there was no reason for them to think that he was going to go to New York. So that's not a bad, for like 2 days worth of work.
Yeah. This probably covers like
money.
The same as taking a group of people out on a safari or whatever. Yeah.
I wanted to jump back real quick because you had mentioned like the helicopter shot when they fly in. I think that says a lot about the cinematographer for this movie because Australia, especially the outback of Australia, is notoriously known for having like nothing to see, right? And the fact that he filled up the screen with like just beauty, is a testament to his skill.
Yeah,
and there's a lot of it through this first half of the movie, the Australian half.
Sure,
just beautiful scenery.
The first half of this movie is an Australian tourism commercial.
Absolutely.
They picked some great spots to film.
Was it just me or like to me? I thought Walt seemed kind of nervous.
Yeah,
in the thing, like maybe they're on the brink of bankrupt. You know, like the company, or just that they've got a lot of riding on this. They need this interview to go well.
Out in the middle of nowhere in the Northern Territory, even like the most ardent backpackers or adventure tourists. I mean, that's a hard place to go visit. Hard place to get to, I would imagine.
Sure, yeah.
If you don't have the money. So she says, she confirms, I am willing to pay $2,500, but I expect to see where Dundee was attacked and to know how he survived. So we cut to later that night. Walt's taking Sue to the local watering hole. That bar is awesome, by the way. If not a little overlit, it's a little light in there. Turn the lights on.
Everyone in that place looked like they needed a shower.
Dust blown like grapes of wrath. People.
It's like you can almost smell it.
You want to talk about great casting of extras? Yeah,
I feel like those had to be authentic, like people who lived out in that
area. Definitely.
Yeah.
And I bet like Paul and Paul Hogan and whoever else are like, I've got some buddies that would be great.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
So Sue notices some good blokes, to use a Australian word, named Donk and Nugget, mm-hmm. who are great names, taking bets on their little beer challenge. The littler guys punch Donk, who's holding a full beer glass over his head. They punch him in the stomach.
Well, who can make him spill?
Donk has apparently never spilt a drop.
So I don't
think it's a memorable gag.
I don't think that should count because Donk holds the beer, right? Am I wrong? Doesn't he hold the beer? If you put the beer on your head and you're like this and you get punched and you don't drop it,
that's a good call.
That is a great.
But
call.
He holds the beer.
I guess the thing is, no one can maybe sort of double over or whatever.
If he like gingerly is holding it by the handle, maybe. But yeah. I get your point to like, if
it would be better. Be holding the beer.
Man, missed opportunity.
That would have been, that actually would have been, but I agree.
It's a movie, right? You can make that happen.
Yeah,
like,
sure.
You can just have him not holding it and have somebody punch him in the stomach and then not drop a beer.
Definitely.
And add to the mythology of the film, you know?
Yeah, I'm definitely with you.
Donk would have been a much more prominent character. As it is, he is not. So Sue asks Walt if Dundee partakes in these kinds of antics. But no, he's like, Walt's like, no, he's more reserved. He's very reserved.
Right. Yeah.
So Walt goes into telling Sue the legend of Crocodile Dundee. There he was doing a quiet spot of fishing when all of a sudden, bang! And apparently a giant crocodile came up, turned him over, bit half his leg off, and dragged him under. Dundee, of course, killed the crocodile. I mean, any normal man would have just turned up his toes and died. But not our Mick, no. Hundreds of miles, snake-infested swamps. On his hands and knees, he crawled right into Catherine. And then the bartender, Ida, butts in, straight past the hospital and into the first pub for a beer. And, like, accuses him of, like, blowing the story up.
He's like, yeah, this story gets better every time. Yeah. It's like a tall tale.
Yeah. So Walt looks deflated. Because, I mean, that's like, Walt is their commercial.
Sure.
You got to know something fishy is going on at this point.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Something's not adding up about the story.
It almost doesn't make sense that he would tell that tall tale. Because, like, obviously, the truth's going
to
come
out.
That's
what I got in. Like, it's weird to be saying that shit when she's about to meet him.
Yeah.
But anyway.
No one said Walt was a good businessman, just that he is the businessman.
He's a huckster, yeah.
So at that moment, a knife comes whipping through the air and, like, slams right into the bar. Sue, like, jumps up scared. She's, like, startled. A commotion breaks out in the bar as a man comes through the door, and he's wrestling a crocodile. Everybody that's in there is, like, scattering around. Sue's freaked out, but it becomes apparent quickly that this crocodile is not alive. The man who stumbled in, like, picks it up and cozies up to the bar. It's like, two beers, one for me, one for me, mate. And this is Michael J. Crocodile Dundee.
Great introduction.
Yeah it's
one
very
of the, one of the classics for sure.
You had, like, the crocodile leather vest on, no shirt.
It's one of the, I'm telling you, it's like, I remember this movie so well that I was, as I was watching this, it was like, no time had passed since the last time I'd seen it. I was like, I remember every detail of this movie.
And I bought it, and I hadn't probably seen it in 10 years. Mm-hmm. And as I'm watching it, it was all just flooding back the memories.
Yeah.
I can remember beat for beat what was going to happen next. It was awesome.
He had that. I liked that he had that big, like, pimpin' feather in his hat.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
As well. Like, I don't know what kind of bird that's off of, but, man, that was sweet.
So he immediately notices Wally and Sue, pulls his knife out of the bar, croc under an arm, and moseys over. He and Sue are immediately giving each other the long up and down. Like, both of them are, like, looking at each other.
Well, I think she's like, where's your missing leg, motherfucker?
Yeah.
That's what I got. Like,
It looked sexy to me.
Okay.
Well, he was definitely giving her the up and down.
Hey, you don't get many women of that quality probably in Walkabout Creek.
Definitely
well,
not.
You don't like Ida?
Shit.
You know what, though? I will say that other bartender, the auxiliary bartender, was smoking.
Auxiliary. I want to be known as auxiliary bartender.
Dundee was, like, giving steady wisecracks, though. Just a jokester, man.
Yeah.
So, like, music cranks up in the background. Mick grabs Sue, starts dancing with her. All of his friends are, like, hooting and hollering.
Which, that's a little bit obnoxious of him.
Yeah, I agree.
I think he's supposed to rub us wrong.
At first?
A little bit at first. Like, this dude's just grabbing this woman and dragging, like, you know, he's just sort of pushy guy.
Right.
And brash and loud. And
the way I looked at it, I feel like, I don't think this is Mick on a regular Tuesday night, right? I think that he knows that they have, like, this big city reporter in town.
Oh, good call.
I think he's shit-faced.
He's trying to play the character.
I'm sure he is.
That's an interesting point. He's not.
We haven't seen him.
He does get sort of tipsy later on in the movie.
I don't remember him ever being, like, drunk in the film.
He's not drunk.
Yeah. He was a little wobbly at one point, towards the end. But yeah.
I think he's just making a big show. I think that's why he was late. I think he was, like, he came
building
in.
Building the suspense.
Yeah, I think that's why he threw the knife in. I think that's why he came in wrestling the cross.
So you don't think he does this every night?
No. I think every other night he just walks in the bar and is like, give me a beer, right?
That's a fucking astute observation, and it makes me, like, 100%, I'm not as bothered by him just, like, grabbing Sue to dance. I think he's just showing her,
he's playing he's being a character.
Yeah, he's playing,
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay. Well, yeah, I think through the movie we will see, he's, I think, trying to act the way that he thinks that the tourists will have stories to take home. Right. You know what
sure.
I mean? Like,
which is actually kind of frustrating because he is the person that he really is.
Well, then you see him in New York where he's the fish out of water, and he's like a genuine, affable gentleman guy.
Everyone loves him. Yeah.
And he doesn't have to try that hard. So Sue seems unamused by all this, says she thought a crocodile had bitten half his leg off. Dundee says that that's a slight exaggeration and rolls up his pants leg to show her a massive scar. A love bite, isn't that what he calls it?
It was just a love bite or something, yeah.
Sue stares. Everyone, I mean, it's because it's a nasty-looking scar.
It is.
And exchange a fleeting glance.
I think it was enough to impress Sue. It's like, okay, at least there's some truth,
exactly.
a grain of truth to this story.
Right. I think that's the first time that he kind of, like, really shows him his true self.
Yeah.
Like, he's like, no, this is the real me. Like, this was, that story is exaggerated, but this is the real story. This is really me right here, this giant scar. And that kind of comes out in threads throughout the whole film, you know?
Yeah. She was into it, I think. There was like a little glance
between
them.
They go back to dancing, and his charms seem to be breaking through. Sue's smiling. There's, like, right next to where they are, there's this group of hunters who have not been amused by Mick's antics. The ringleader, who we know by his big glasses and cowboy hat, like, loudly accuses Mick of being a croc poacher.
Yeah. Wait, I gotta say, the youngest dude in that crew is Brett Hogan, Paul's son.
Huh.
What? No way, really?
Who was, I think, older than Linda Kozlowski, which is kind of a little creepy.
Wow.
That was like his child from, I mean, he got married when he was like 18 to his original wife or something. I think they had
a kid.
He was
born at like 36.
At the same time. So I think he did have a child who was about 30. And and Kozlowski was maybe 28 or something.
Man, you did some research, dude.
Yeah, well, it's a little creepy when it's
young,
like,
but I didn't know that
that's my new, he's going to cheat on my mom with this.
I mean, that's my new boo thing.
They didn't know that at the point, right?
She's your age, son. And the son's like, I want to fuck my stepmom.
That's like some militant.
Exactly.
Remember when I asked your mom to prom?
Shut up, Ted. So, Sue is telling Dundee that she wants him to take her out to where he was attacked and give her the full story of how he survived. Just the two of us out there alone? Got my reputation to think about. So the ringleader.
I love the fact that he's a jokester. He doesn't take himself seriously.
He's Peter Pan. I love it. So the ringleader, like, reaches over of the douches that are sitting at the table. He slaps Mick on the butt and asks where a fella can shoot a few crocs. And Mick seems to, like, he's like,
how would I know? Shit for
he
brains.
He doesn't like the croc poaching. Yeah. Wisecrack. So he calls the dude shit for brains. The guy gets up, takes his glasses off. He's like, every man and his dog in the joint knows you're nothing but a bloody croc poacher, which I still don't understand. Like, I guess that's just how rumors get started. Or maybe, do you think Mick maybe did have a shady past? Doesn't seem likely.
I mean, we
given
know
his connection
for sure he was maybe out there doing that very thing, right?
Yeah. And there's a couple points.
He says
where
he was just fishing.
But there's like, there's some gun shells all in his like boat.
Barramundi's a big fish.
Oh, fair enough.
A bloody big fish.
Maybe Mick is a reformed poacher. Perhaps.
What would you do? Like, is it the skin? You sell the skin?
Yeah, you sell the skin, the bones.
Maybe the teeth.
Taxidermy,
like,
things like that.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Put him in your hat. He does have a crocodile tooth hat. Anyway.
He's killed a croc before.
Yeah, so.
We know this.
Dundee punches the shit out of that dude with one epic punch.
That punch was amazing.
He's a one-punch guy, too, right?
He is throughout the movie.
Everybody he hits
just
is like one punch, and they're like out.
That one hitter quitter.
Yeah.
And then he goes right back to dancing with Sue.
Nobody in the bar really is like,
well,
upset about
the regulars
it
are like, get these fuckers out of here.
And don't come back. Yeah, so they're they're happy to see him go. Mick apologizes, but says he won't tolerate them using bad language in front of a lady. clearly sensitive about the poaching accusations, which we'll talk about later.
I mean, I guess by definition, it is a crime.
Yeah, totally.
Dude, the extras, man. That dude in the mesh T-shirt.
Oh, yeah.
Did that guy catch your eye?
Oh, that was a whole room bag.
I don't know. Nah, I don't know if he was that guy or not. There was just a dude who looked shit-faced drunk, who had like a mesh T-shirt on. It was just filthy looking. Like, just
they were all nasty looking.
These dudes, they had to have been real.
Do you think like I don't know who would be in charge of that, like
community bathing and walkabout?
Well, just like in the movie and in general, like would that be costumes? Would that be
costumes
production?
And makeup?
Yeah, fuck. Did they just like slap a bunch of dirt on these guys? And
the dirt, yes, but I almost feel like the clothes almost just seem like that's just wear what you got.
And they had, maybe that was
they definitely will
change you up if you need
those
to.
Clothes, right?
There's a studio portrait of my younger brother and myself when we were 1 and 2 years old, where I am wearing a mesh tank top.
Oh, hell yeah.
That's why anyone thought that was the look for the portrait.
Well, I think we all know, like, these characters are sort of like the Australian version of rednecks.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of. And I wondered to myself, like, if Australians find this movie offensive.
I've wondered that.
Like, if they're like, come on,
that's
the rest of the
question.
World, like, is this what you think? I mean, or it spreads the image of, like, this is Australians.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's a good question.
But it's like cosmopolitan Australians are like, they don't shoot for all of us.
People in Sydney and Brisbane and Melbourne are like, we're not like this at all.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I feel the same when there's just characters from Georgia.
Yeah.
And it's like, and they're dumb hicks or whatever, or all racists or whatever it is. So
at that moment, Mick breaks away from the dance to go have a go at Donk in the beer challenge. He makes like he's going to punch him, but then just like sort of steps up gently and lays a big kiss on him. Donk flings the beer back and then just starts swinging away and like trying to fucking kill him.
I feel like not really though, right? Was he putting on a macho display?
I think that Donk was like trying to hit him.
I like that first swing for sure, yeah.
And I don't think that it's the first time that Mick and Donk have fought, probably. They've probably been at it before.
Okay.
So the crowd's like, everyone's laughing. Donk like calms down pretty quickly when he gets a fresh beer.
See, that's when Dundee slid up to that bartender, like the other one who had it going on and sort of was snuggling up with her.
Yeah, but again, I think it was all for show. The fact that he even had the idea to like best Donk on that particular night. Like any other night, he wouldn't have cared,
but
right?
I do think Dundee is like the life of the party, though, right?
Oh, yeah, always. Yeah.
He's like everyone's best friend or whatever.
Have you ever known a Mick Dundee in real life? That one guy that just shows up and it's like electrifies the place.
Yeah. I hate those guys.
I was about to say they never have like good backstories, right?
Yeah, they usually like.
They're not likable.
They usually have abused their charisma.
it's a shame, but it's true.
Yeah, there's always like a sad part of that story.
So Walt is apologetic to Sue about all this, but she seems intrigued by what she's seen. So we cut to,
I think she knows it's going to be a good article.
Yeah, like, this story's going to
kick
ass.
This guy's a character.
This is my Pulitzer. So cut to the next day. Mick, Walt, and Sue are driving through this beautiful yet rugged landscape. It is amazing scenery. They're bumping around in that like open-sided truck with the boat lashed to the roof.
Yeah, that thing that was the thing when I saw it, having not seen the movie in forever. I'm like, oh, it's that fucking car. Like, I could have drawn that from memory, I think. Yeah.
And then this whole scene is some shit that's like coming up like the with the water buffalo, some stuff that I still do today, like with the little, anyway. So while they're riding, Sue says she hopes that Mick isn't reluctant to talk about himself, and he's like, nah, it's my favorite subject. So she asks where the crocodile nickname came from, and he's like, that was Walt's idea because it's good for tourism. She asks how old he is, but Dundee says he doesn't know. She doesn't believe him, but Walt explains that Mick was raised among the local Aboriginal tribe, and that they don't really keep track of things like that. That one of the elders told him, you know, when asked, that hey, you were born in the summertime, and that's all we know.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And it's at this point that we should probably discuss a little bit of preferred nomenclature.
Yeah, I would say like we don't really have a grasp of Australian politics or like what's politically correct in Australia. Off the top, we'll say that.
Right.
So if we say something that's wrong, like please chalk it up to that and feel free to contact us and let us know if, you know, email or social media or whatever. But like anytime we're going to make reference occasionally to Aboriginal people, in the course of discussing the movie, and I've done research on the subject to try to educate myself. So please forgive me if any research is incorrect.
There's a massive movement in Australia, which I wish that the United States would follow suit, you know, and emulate, called the Reconciliation Movement. And it's a, I mean, it's a government program. And the nomenclature that the Reconciliation Program uses is Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. So I think Aboriginal is like the best that you can get to from like a government accepted, you know, thing.
I mean, from what I gather, it is a lot like Native American people here in the U.S. Like, that there's not a, it's a complex issue and there's not a like firm consensus. Yeah.
And that most of those people would rather be called by the language that they speak because they speak so many different tribal languages.
It makes sense, right? Because like people aren't a monolith. Like, you can't just say everyone agrees on this thing.
And then from my viewpoint, I distinctly remember when America made the transition from being, because I'm black, guys, made the transition from being black to being African-American.
And now black is the preferred
and
term.
And now,
right?
So I remember when, like, my white friends would call me African-American, how weird that sounded to me. Like, I never thought of myself
what
that
feels
way.
Normal now?
I'm black. I've always just been, like, a black guy, you know? And I've never, honestly, I feel weird if somebody calls me African. It feels too proper, you know?
Sure.
So, but that's me. So it's... it's what Kevin's saying. We're definitely not trying to be disrespectful or offend anybody when we say what we say. Obviously, what you want to be called is your right.
Right, sure.
But it's not our intention to offend.
Totally.
So this movie uses the outdated term of Aborigine.
Right.
Which is, out of favor with the community now. With good reason. Like, I read a great quote where those people from that group say, we didn't give ourselves that name, you know, so that's why it's offensive. Like, and a lot of those same people feel the same way about Aboriginal and Torres Islands. There's Torres Strait Islander people, because it's like, those aren't words that we used before white people came here and told us that's what we were, you know? So I totally get it.
Yeah.
So it's, so having said that, it is a little weird that, cause I feel like Paul Hogan is somebody who's truly in love with Australia and totally has respect for his country. So I can't imagine that he would intentionally be disrespectful to...
Well, I think that was just, that was the word.
Like, yeah, that was just the word.
The same way that you
could... But obviously there had to have been another word that they were calling themselves.
I don't
know.
Just
didn't...
I think, like, if you went to the 1950s, like, everyone would talk about Indians in America. And even people maybe who loved the culture and loved Native American people, but that was just the word. So I don't know. It seems like in a perfect world, like we'll call you what you want to be called. For the purposes of this podcast, I think we'll use the generic, Aboriginal people.
The most widely accepted term that we could find was Aboriginal.
With no malice. But as Mike says, I get the vibe from the movie that Paul Hogan and the other filmmakers were trying, especially with the Aboriginal that they're very respectful.
With the Aboriginal people in Australia, and then when the character is transplanted to the U.S. with his dealings with black people, he seems open and...
I think he's really reverent of... in the context of the movie, supposedly that's the community that Crocodile Dundee grew up in.
Yeah, he was raised by. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know, so anyway.
Yeah.
Side
track. So there you have that.
But yeah, back to the film, I suppose.
But it's an appointment.
No, it's important.
Totally
it's
is.
Important,
totally
though,
is.
For sure.
Because it comes up a few times in this movie, and it's worth explaining. So then Sue asks Mick if there's a Mrs. Crocodile Dundee, and he says, I love it. I was sort of married once. Nice girl, good cook, big, and then makes
big
tracts of land sort of deal. But he's like, I went on walkabout, and when I got back, she was gone. She's lost on the word walkabout, which Walt explains means to wander around to discover new places, which is a charitable definition, which I think is the accurate definition, but not in Mick's case, because Mick was gone for 18 months, apparently.
I like that moment where, like, Sue sort of sarcastically is like, oh, she didn't stick around.
Strange. Yeah, Mick's then, like, yeah.
And the way Wally said it, I was wondering, was, like, not his daughter, but was, like, his niece? Or he kind of said it in, like, yeah, you're a little dick for doing what you did.
Yeah, you get the feeling that Walt has been around for all of this stuff and sort of had to, like,
surrogate
watch.
Father type?
Yeah, exactly.
I'm sorry, is it Walt or Wally?
Both.
It's all of the above.
Interchangeable.
Walt,
you call him whatever
Wally,
you
Walt.
You call him whatever
Walt.
You want to call him.
Yeah.
As Mick turns his attention back to the road, he breaks suddenly, and this is the moment that I still to this day, when trying to like get something to go my way, will like make the hand gesture in this.
You make the noise.
So there's a water buffalo standing in the middle of the road. Mick honks the horn. It's not moving. So he gets out of the truck and approaches it. Sue starts snapping pictures, and Mick seems to like do this weird hand gesture thing and like mesmerizing. He's like humming, and it just plops down in the middle of the road. And she's amazed.
I don't really see how that's any better for them than having it standing in the middle of the road. It's blocking the road still, right?
Okay, I'm going to drive around it now. I don't
it's
know.
Like a cool trick, but it doesn't actually accomplish anything.
Well, then something I don't understand. So Walter calls it, Ma never matter, an old Bushman's trick. And then he makes this face as though he's like annoyed with Mick or something. I don't even know, like, is he mad that he showed off his superpower, or is he mad that, like, what's the deal with that face? I was wondering that all day. I was like, I don't understand. Like, why
I didn't
is he
even
sort
catch
of annoyed?
That look.
Yeah, he makes this, it's sort of like if Superman had done something and your friend who's trying to keep the fact that
it's
you're
secret.
Superman from people.
Ah.
And he's like, oh yeah, it's just that. No.
But he's
like,
just using his TV vision to like heat up a hot pocket or something. Like, really, Superman, God damn it.
Yeah. And he's like, fuck. So it's sort of the vibe that I got from Wally there.
Apparently they had that water buffalo like all doped up.
Oh, sure. Can you imagine like a wild?
Sad.
You know they got that from the Australian zoo.
Probably. Sure. Sydney Zoo. So yeah, we cut to some more beautiful nature photography of a boat out on the lake.
Mm-hmm.
The tree are cruising along in a shallow lake in
landscape.
A John boat.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it's like big lily pads and flowers and things.
They filmed all this stuff at this Kakadu National Park in Australia.
All right.
Huge place. Awesome.
Yeah.
We talked about it on Road Warrior. Like, I want to get to Australia.
I want to spend 3 weeks there.
No, it definitely makes me want to travel there for sure. Yeah,
it's so cool.
And they did a good job of showing, because every time I think of Australia, I think of like all the animals that will kill you, right? Like the snakes and spiders. But they did a good job of not really showing that, right? I mean, they showed the crocodiles and there's a snake, but I think like the running joke is literally every animal there can kill you. And I didn't really get
Australia
that.
Australia has evolved to cause harm to human beings, which makes you wonder why we decided to make a colony there. But anyway. It's because there are precious metals there, you guys. That's why.
Of course.
So while they're riding in the boat, Mick points out a crocodile on a bank. Sue's like freaked out and she like jumps. Then there's this dissolve effect and we see the boat pulling up to a shore. They're unloading their gear from the boat. Walt tells Sue that he's going to be back to pick them up at their destination in a couple of days.
Sue was looking good.
I do love this thing where as Mick is walking by Walt, he kind of like grabs his arm and looks at his watch, and then like kind of like looking up in the sun, like just like it's about 2:20. Better get a move on.
I love that shit. That's what I'm saying. Like he pulls that shit, I think, just to put on a show for Sue.
Yeah, no,
like for her benefit. So just it'll be good for her article.
It's gonna be good for the article.
But you know what's so frustrating is that there's scenes like that where he looks at Walt's watch and he's like, "Oh, it's 2:20, right?" But then there's a scene like 10 seconds later, we actually does some mystical, magical shit.
He
right?
does have it like that.
So
yeah, he's got it like that.
I wouldn't be surprised if he really could look at the sun and tell you that it's 2:20.
But maybe not to the minute.
And maybe
I
he
would
was,
not be surprised.
Maybe he was feeling lazy at that moment. He was just like, I don't have time to put the stick in the ground and do the sundial thing.
Uh-huh.
I love that Sue's amazed. Walt plays right along at a little bit of like a brilliant bit of self-promotion. He's like, Mick's the best bushman in the territory and the best pupil I ever had. Attaboy.
Walt's amazing.
So Mick and Sue set off into the wilderness. Walt calls out, until winds die. And then Mick, what's today, Walt? Monday. And he's like, nods.
What a life. Dundee has.
I love the writing from Walt at that moment is like, it's the truth that we should all ascribe to. And that is in regard to Mick not knowing what day it is, doesn't know, doesn't care. Lucky bastard.
Yeah.
It's like, fuck yeah. That would be the thing. It doesn't matter what day it is.
That's when you hit the sweet spot of a vacation is when you lose the track of what day of the week it is.
It's kind
of
what, like, the pandemic was, right?
For sure. Weekends kind of lost all meaning. Exactly. Like,
there was definitely a point during the pandemic. I was like, what day is it?
I don't know who I am anymore.
My question is, why did Walt have to go out there with him?
To bring the boat back?
I think he had to take the boat back.
Is that what it was?
Okay. I guess so. I don't know. But that's the, I mean, yeah, you're right. He's
literally,
I think he's just their ride. And to take the truck back.
And also, I think to maybe set the lady reporter at ease and not being out there with just a rando for the entire time. I don't know. Maybe not.
Yeah.
She's probably used to that sort of thing.
I guess so. But that seems like that's a hefty first episode.
Yeah.
We covered a lot of ground in
we
the
sure
outback.
Sure did.
From one end of the territory to the other.
Sure did.
We hope you guys will join us next time, including all of our friends at the Last of the Action Heroes Podcast Network.
Oh, yeah. Hey, what's up, guys? We see you.
All of our friends out in Australia, we love you. We're doing this one for you guys again after we hope we didn't botch Road Warrior too bad. And and we'll be back.